produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, World Drug Report 2025. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime released the 2025 edition of its annual World Drug Report on June 26th. Recently, the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy and UNODC held a pair of online events to discuss the World Drug Report. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, we're going to hear portions of the U.S. event. One of the speakers on that U.S. webinar was Daniel Ciccaroni, MD, MPH. Dr. Ciccaroni is a professor of family community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Here's his presentation.
But let's just start with some obvious things. And as an epidemiologist, if I want to know whether a drug is a problem or if drug use in general is a problem, we look at the population at risk. On the left here, we see the global number of people who use drugs, estimates from this report, showing an increase in both the number of folks who use drugs, 28%, and prevalence, adjusting for the growth of the global population of 13%. Now, if you look carefully, you'll see that there's big error bars. And so there actually may be no difference in both number and prevalence. That would be the more accurate way of looking at this. In terms of picking up where Angela left off, opioid use internationally is stable. It's problematic in some regions, as I'll talk about. ATS are up, right? And they're up in both the traditional areas like Southeast Asia, but also expanding to new areas like the Middle East. Cocaine, that graph that Angela showed, very impressive. Cocaine distribution, use, and consequences are increasing in many regions of the world. But having said that prevalence and use is going up, or maybe it's flat, depending on how we want to interpret those graphs, we have to look at the consequences, which are growing faster. And they're growing faster because of a chaotic and unpredictable drug supply. So looking at the graph on the right, we see both the years of life lost on the left, as well as deaths on the right. And we just look at the drug use. For this slide, we're just going to look at the drug use bars, and we'll see in sort of brick red our dailies lost due to opioids and deaths lost due to opioids. Above that, we see amphetamines, cannabis, cocaine, relatively stable, but not the opioids. Opioids increased 60% in the same 10-year time period as the graph on the left. And why is this? Because the increase in structural risk due to a chaotic and varying, changing vicissitudes in a synthetic drug supply. It's become very complex. It's become global. It's not just fentanyl in North America. It's synthetic drugs internationally. We can talk about fentanyls briefly. This is a graph from the US. This is the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control. We see an eightfold increase in deaths due to fentanyls, including the analogs in North America. And there is a decline, which we don't know the reasons for. We're debating it as we speak. There should be studies coming out in due course. But if some of those reasons could have been temporary, right? Could have been a supply shock, could have been a COVID effect, right? And so there's a little bubble in that data there showing that deaths to fentanyls may be going up again. There's controversy about that data point, so stay tuned. But I also want to talk about this, the opium drought that's happening due to Afghanistan production going way down. This is leading to supply shortages of opium-derived products like heroin. In Europe, in its primary market, which is Europe, there are stockpiles. From what I look at the data, and Bo and Angela probably know this better, these stockpiles last about 2 years, maybe a little longer. Eventually, they will dry up if production doesn't continue. What are the consequences of this? The expansion of nitazenes, particularly in Europe, but also worldwide. There's 20 different varieties now in 28 countries. It's more potent than fentanyl. But there's also hints in terms of supply that fentanyl could also go to Europe during this opium drought. And of course, it's not just those two drugs. In terms of other opioids, is methadone, increase in use and consequences in Eastern Europe, there's tramadol and codeine, use and consequences in West and South Africa. And of course, it's also not just the opioids. There are other synthetics like the ATS, which are on the rise in Southeast Asia. Particular interest to me, because it caught my attention, is the rise of Captagon use in the Middle East. The other thing that caught my attention in thinking about morbidity, so not just mortality now, but let's think about morbidity, is the consequences due to acute hepatitis, acute and chronic hepatitis, which are downstream effects from injection drug use. There's some sexual risk involved here as well, but a lot of it is also injection drug-related risk. Let's look at this graph for a second, right? So we talked before about deaths attributable to use of drugs. We talked about that rise in opiate use and opioid use disorders. That's still in brick red down below. But look at those blue bars. These are deaths attributable to hepatitis, particularly hepatitis B, both acute and chronic, and also its long-term sequela, which is cirrhosis and chronic liver disease, including cirrhosis and liver cancer. There's a small contribution there to hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a bigger problem in North America and Europe, but worldwide, it's hepatitis B. The thing is, this is preventable, right? We have vaccinations for hepatitis A and hepatitis B. They should be, at this point, cost-effective, right? Greatly cost-effective, because they've been around for a while. We also know, in terms of the hepatitis C incidence, and again, thinking about North America and Europe, that the combination of providing sterile syringes and opioid agonist treatment will lead to a decrease in hepatitis C incidence. And hepatitis C is treatable. Hepatitis B is treatable. We have antiretrovirals, so high, good evidence base for not only preventing this, but also treating them. What's the problem? What's the barrier? Of course, competition for resources. But these, again, cost-effective. So arguments could be made that, yes, competition for resources, but you'll save resources by saving lives. If I was going to put an emphasis, and that's why I'm spending so much time on this slide, on something that we could do to reduce morbidity and mortality worldwide from drug use, it would be this: hepatitis. Of course, there's also gaps in treatment provision. We know that there's an evidence base that treatment, effective treatments like opioid agonist therapy, decreases morbididity and mortality. If we look at the graph on the right, in terms of the estimated proportion of people who use drugs that receive treatment, Europe's doing pretty well. Oceania and America's so-so. But look at that gap in Asia and Africa, very low access to effective treatment. Worldwide, 8% are receiving treatment, men, and then there's a gender gap where women are receiving treatment a lot less than men do. And of course, the barriers here are stigma, both culture-based and prejudicial law enforcement-based, and also the internalized version of stigma called shame, which leads people to not seek treatment. And of course, resources are a problem, and quality, what we call a good treatment, evidence-based treatment, versus lower quality forms of treatment. International standards say treatment must be voluntary and evidence-based. Compulsory treatment doesn't work. Although there's calls for it now in many places, and there's certainly been persistence of its use in resource-poor areas. The UN has concerns about this globally. Good studies come out from Canada showing that there's no difference between those who are coerced into treatment versus those who voluntarily enter treatment over a 10-year period. Good study. Of course, there's also prevention gaps in terms of sterile syringe provision. Think again about that hepatitis B and C that we just talked about. Naloxone distribution is still a problem in many places. Again, considering the variety of opioids and the distribution of opioids worldwide is becoming a problem. Opioid agonist treatment is considered an essential medication by the World Health Organization.
That was Dr. Daniel Ciccarone, professor of family community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, speaking at an event organized by the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime to discuss UNODC's World Drug Report 2025. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On July 10th, UNAIDS released its 2025 Global AIDS Update. One of the speakers at that event was Jawan Bediwani, Program Coordinator of Adolescent Girls and Young Women Network, South Sudan.
South Sudan is a country with closely 12 million of population countrywide. Over 9 million of the population are people with humanitarian concern. Around 400,000 people are living with HIV, but only 51% of the people know their status. The ATR coverage is only at 47% with 8,100 new infections in 2023. New infections reduced by 45% since 2010, which is still way below average in Eastern and Southern Africa, where there is a 59% decline in new HIV infections over the same period. In 2023, there were twice as many new infections among women aged 15 and above compared to the men. Inequalities stem from persistent levels of sexual and gender-based violence. A study conducted in 2027 by the Global Women Institute and the International Rescue Committee indicates that 65% of women and girls have experienced physical and sexual violence in their lifetime, and over 51% have suffered intimate partner violence. I would like to take you on the humanitarian context of South Sudan. It was just yesterday, which is 9th of July, 2025, the Republic of South Sudan celebrated its 14 years of independence. Over the past 13 years, we have been suffering with civil unrest despite that 14 years of celebration. As a result of this, high levels of humanitarian needs affect a large population, and those girls and young women particularly are vulnerable to HIV infections. In South Sudan, under the humanitarian context, there is a lot of insecurity, in a way that there is a lot of political instability. There is intercommunal conflict, and there is a lot of natural disaster, which is like the floods. This interrupts the adolescents from accessing services in form of education, health services, and also leads to early marriages in the context of the humanitarian context. So it makes it difficult for the adolescents to get services. I can give you one of the example. We, as the peer educators, we had one of our adolescents that happened to share with us her story during the displacement and the political instability, how they separated from the parents. And she ended up staying with the uncle. So the uncle was too much into wealth. So the uncle gave the girl to someone who was rich because the uncle wanted to gain the wealth. The lady was 13 years old, and she was forced by the uncle to get married to a man that she is not aware of his status or about his well-being. So during that process, the lady got pregnant, and the man was HIV positive. She was too young to give birth to a kid who was around 3 kg, making it difficult for her to produce. So she went for a labor period of around 1 week and 3 days. The adolescent girls and young women, we look at also the incidence of the poverty, that is economic security, insecurity in South Sudan. We are facing a lot of economic insecurity as adolescents in South Sudan, where most of the ladies are now going through transactional sex as a way of survival for them to get something that can sustain their living. Then when you look at the culture also of South Sudan, we are facing a lot of issues when it comes to culture. In our culture of South Sudan, women's dignity are not being respected. It is a taboo for someone to speak about the use of condoms, even for you to go and get family planning without acceptance of your husband. It is a taboo. You're supposed to first get a permission before, and you go and get the family planning method. So it really makes it difficult for the adolescent girls to go and get services. And there is also a lot of issue when it comes to stigma and discrimination. Most of the ladies who are having HIV, they really fear to go and get service because they have that fear within the community or maybe within the facilities where they're going to get services from. Maybe there is a story of one of our peers also who shared with us how she's HIV positive because she got it from the parents, and it was really difficult for her to study in school. Every school that she goes to, people know that she's HIV positive, and people fear to interact with her because of her status. So the parent keep on shifting her from one school to another, and she ended up even leaving school because of the stigma.
That was Jawan Bediwani, program coordinator of the Adolescent Girls and Young Women Network of South Sudan, speaking at the launch of UNAIDS' new 2025 Global AIDS Update, entitled AIDS, Crisis, and the Power to Transform. Welcome back. Now let's hear more from that event organized by the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime to discuss UNODC's World Drug Report 2025. One of the other speakers on that panel was Daniel Mejia, PhD, an associate professor at the Department of Economics at the University of the Andes in Bogota, Colombia. His presentation focused on the environmental impact section of the World Drug Report.
This chapter has a focus on Europe, because it's an initial, I think it's an initial attempt to understand and gather the information on the environmental effects of illicit drugs on the environment. And the chapter starts by stating that illicit drugs affect the environment through three different channels, which are kind of obvious: production and trafficking, consumption, and drug policy responses. All these activities contribute to deforestation, changes in land use. This is especially the case in producer countries. And in consumer countries, it has to do with the contamination of the air, soil, and water sources. Both in producer and consumer countries, we have clandestine laboratories that discharge toxic waste and drug residues from consumption that are present in water, in wastewater systems. And this poses risk on human health, biodiversity, and ecosystem. This is what the chapter states, and I think this is very clear. The key findings of the chapter, with a focus in Europe, is that although small in overall scale when compared to legal industries, illicit drug activities impose significant and localized environmental cost, are imposing significant and localized environmental cost in Europe. The chapter focuses on synthetic drug manufacturing that generates hazardous waste volumes that can be up to, this is quite impressive, 58 times higher or greater than the output product, which are most of the time dumped illegally. Countries like the Netherlands or Belgium report dozens of dumping incidents annually, and a shift towards smaller residential labs raises additional risk, including toxic emissions and wastewater contamination. The chapter also focuses on indoor cannabis cultivation vis-a-vis outdoors cultivation of cannabis. Indoor cannabis cultivation is dominant mostly in Western and Northern Europe and has a particular large carbon footprint due to energy intensive lighting and ventilation. And the chapter estimates from a study in North America that indoor cannabis cultivation can emit up to 50 times more CO2 emissions per kilogram than output cultivation. I think that the chapter's most relevant contribution has to do with the first life cycle assessment of an illicit synthetic drug. And the chapter estimates that 1 kilogram of MDMA emits between 400 and 1500 kilogram of CO2 equivalent emissions. This is roughly 0.07 to 0.31 kilograms of CO2 equivalent emissions per ecstasy pill. And this environmental cost exceeds that of comparable legal pharmaceutical production by between 30 and 60%. This is quite an impressive number. The chapter also identifies key policy gaps and innovation. First of all, the environmental protection has not been central to European drug policies. And most of the enforcement activities remain reactive and focused on interdiction rather than on the assessment of the ecological impact of illicit drugs. Few countries, with the exception of mainly Belgium and France, explicitly incorporate environmental concerns into their drug strategies. However, innovations are emerging. For instance, wastewater-based monitoring is widely used to track drug use and could also detect illegal production effluents in the water systems. One project that is highlighted in the chapter is the EU-funded MicroMole project that deploys robotic sensors in sewer systems to trace synthetic drugs discharges. And the chapter also highlights Colombia's Goldfish program, which basically tracks cocaine processing chemicals in rivers and offers another potential model to monitor the environmental cost of the illicit drug production activities. I have a few comments on the chapter. I think it presents a very innovative and policy relevant analysis and makes a significant contribution by spotlighting the often overlooked environmental dimension of drug markets. The chapter consolidates evidence that illicit drug production and trafficking harm ecosystems through waste, pollution, and carbon emissions, and has insights that are highly relevant for both drug policy and environmental governance. I think, as I said before, the chapter's most important contribution is, in my view, the life cycle assessments of the MDMA. And this is a pioneering effort that quantifies the climate impacts, offering a concrete basis for policy dialogue on drug-related carbon of the carbon footprint of the production of MDMA. By mapping how drug supply, use, and enforcement each intersect with environmental harm, the chapter broadens the perspective of policy experts beyond public health and security, underlying that illicit drugs also pose environmental risk. The chapter both implicitly and explicitly highlight the need for expanded research. A key takeaway from the chapter is that severe data limitations on the environmental impacts of illicit drug exist, and future research should build on this chapter, groundwork, by examining more in situ environmental damage and more comprehensively. For instance, high-value studies could assess soil and water contamination at former drug labs or cultivation sites across different regions. And such research would help quantify ecological risk and guide cleanup standards in the future. I think it's also the chapter opens the space and motivates replicating the life cycle assessments for other substances. Also, expanding this methodology, the life cycle assessment, to entire supply chains, including illicit crop cultivation and transoceanic trafficking, could be very illuminating to understand the full carbon and ecological footprint of the illicit drug economies. These efforts would address current knowledge gaps and support more evidence-based policy making. On this point, it will be crucial collaboration between environmental scientists and drug policy experts. In terms of the comparative environmental context that it's explained in the chapter, with a focus on, as I said, on the European case, these echoes patterns observed in other drug-producing regions. For instance, in South America, and this is something that I've studied in the past, illicit coca cultivation and cocaine production have been strongly linked to deforestation and ecosystem degradation. A recent analysis in Colombia finds a significant positive relationship between coca crop expansion and forest loss, contributing to what it has been called narco deforestation. Also, drug policies such as the aerial fumigation of illicit crops with glyphosate, practiced in Colombia for many years up to 2015, led to chemical contamination of soils and water sources, and had significant impacts on not only on human health, as I documented in a paper published in the Journal of Health Economics, but also on flora and fauna. This has been documented by other scholars. These parallels suggest that whether in tropical forests or in European waterways, illicit drug economies tend to leave a significant environmental footprint, from greenhouse gas emissions to biodiversity threats. And this merits greater international attention. Integrating these lessons from different regions could, of course, inspire a more holistic and cooperative approach. For example, sharing these technologies for detecting drug pollution or strategies for rehabilitating lands after illicit cultivation in South America or Southeast Asia would be extremely important. Another message that it's important from the chapter is that that of integrating enforcement with environmental protection. The chapter highlights a critical implementation challenge, which is closing the gap between drug enforcement and environmental regulation. At present, most European agencies treat drug-related waste purely as a criminal issue and not as an ecological one. A constructive suggestion is to establish a formal coordination mechanism between narcotic control units and environmental authorities. Implementing some of the chapter insights will require overcoming certain methodological challenges as well. For instance, attribution of pollution is one of such challenges, and that is by basically being able to isolate drug-related contaminants in wastewater or soil from other industrial sources can be extremely difficult. So advancing techniques in wastewater forensics and environmental monitoring will be crucial in the future. Examples of sensor networks in sewers, the MicroMole project that is highlighted in the chapter, or monitoring in rivers, such as the Goldfish project in Colombia, illustrates innovative solutions, but scaling them up will be a huge challenge. Just to conclude, another challenge is the underreporting of environmental incidents tied to drugs. As the chapter notes, only 9 European countries currently report clandestine waste dumping sites in the past decade, whereas 36 countries reporting uncovering drug labs. This discrepancy between drugs labs that have been reported and those that report dumping sites, it's a call to governments that can develop more clear reporting guidelines and encourage the public and local officials to report suspicious waste.
That was Dr. Daniel Mejia, an associate professor of the Department of Economics at the University of the Andes in Colombia, speaking at an event organized by the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime to discuss UNODC's World Drug Report 2025. Copies of the World Drug Report can be downloaded from the UNODC website, which is unodc.org. The International Society for the Study of Drug Policy can be found on the web at issdp.org. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!